Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone to the September Triangle Linux Users Group meeting. Tonight's topic is on the Linux Terminal Server Project. I'd like to ask everyone to go ahead and turn your phones, pagers, cybernetic implants to silent or vibrate, please. Do we have any first timers here tonight? Stand up. You now have 10 seconds to get pizza before the rest of the lug stampede you to eat. Since we have a pretty decent crowd tonight, let's make the first pass two pieces, and after everybody eats, then we can scavenge. And while you're back there, if you're feeling generous, there is a cash box to make donations to Trilug for pizza on the nights that we don't have a sponsor. All right, since most everyone's gotten their pizza, I will, and speaking of pizza, I'd like to thank David McDowell for stepping up and picking up our pizza since our normal transporter was sick this week. Woo! Thank you. And tonight, talking about Solido.net, we have a sponsor. And I'd like to turn it over to Sherritt and let him tell you about Solido.
How's it going, guys? My name is Sherritt. I'm with Solido. We're a local managed internet service provider. We wanted to sponsor this meeting tonight just because we're actually opening a new data center off of, very close to RBC Center. So we're pretty excited. Wanted to announce that. Also, we still have a data center off of Jones Franklin. I don't know if any of you knew Interland way back when, back in 99, that's when we started. We're in that same area, so we outgrew that too, and we're moving over to RBC Center. John told me I have 15 minutes, but I'm just kidding. I'm going to take two more minutes. So if you guys, I pulled up our website because I didn't bring any specific material, didn't want to make it a sales pitch or anything. But if you happen to take a look at our website, if you wanted any co-location or DSL with static IPs, things like that, we do pretty much everything. I'm going to try to work to get on the sponsors page with our promotions for Trilug sometime next week after we get through this move. We're literally moving tomorrow to our new data center, so just kind of run around doing stuff. So anything from T1 starting at about 325 in the Raleigh market, if any of you are looking, with a static block. We also do Metro E 10 meg for about anywhere from 1495 it's usually a 1 to 3 year commitment if you guys are looking for pricing, things like that. And we go all the way up to 100 meg, and that's been a real big hit because of the low latency. We are going to have a link to Charlotte's if any of you guys have branches in Charlotte and stuff. We have about 20 meg down to Charlotte. So that's also there. But if any of that interests you, I'm going to leave a couple cards up here as well, and we'll go from there. So appreciate your attention. Thanks.
Thank you, Sherritt, and thank you for the pizza. Need a job, have a job. I'm almost delinquent in my MC duties. Does anyone know of a job that they'd like to announce? do the Donahue thing.
Okay, thank you. I am looking for a PHP programmer slash LAMP developer. The job is in Wilmington, and it does have to be on site, although we could probably fudge that a little bit. If anybody's interested, let me know. There are a few other things on the side, too, which would be some off-site Linux server support as well, but we could talk about some of that as well. So, there we go.
Talk to me after.
Anybody else?
Here's one.
BB&T has need for a couple of senior firewall guys. The job is in Wilson, but there's some potential for moving to Raleigh soon.
Thank you. Anybody else? Anyone? Does anyone need a job? And that's the only time you're going to see me run.
What do I do?
Your name, all right. What you can do.
Sure. My name is Augie Maciel. I'm a .NET developer, also Red Hat certified engineer. Looking for a job. Working either way, .NET or Linux.
Okay. Cool deal. Thank you. And also, if anyone has a job, they can send it to steering@trilog.org, and we'll send it to the list, and you can get even more people to apply for it. Anything else? Sweet. All right. I'll turn it over to Jason Tower so he can tell us about LTSP.
All right. Mic test. Can everybody hear me all right? Okay, good. My voice is a little weaker than usual, so it should sound normal. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm going to be talking about the Linux Terminal Server Project. Before I start, show of hands, who has ever used LTSP? Oh, quite a few people. Good. All right. But a lot of hands are down, so that's good. So hopefully we'll get a chance to see what this whole thing can do and what it's all about. Whoops. All right, that's not what I want. All righty then. Hey. Okay. I actually spent more time putting the demo and everything together than I did on the slides, so they're not particularly fancy or anything. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the slides and talk a bit about the project and what it does and how it works and all that stuff first. And then I've got some demonstration machines up here. And if anyone else has a laptop that is capable of Pixie booting, we got some extra Ethernet cables. I'd like to see at the end of the night how many machines we can get all running as a thin client before we walk out of here. It'd be kind of neat. Okay. All right. The first thing we're going to talk about with LTSP is what exactly is a terminal server, and by conjuncture, what exactly is a thin client. There's really three kinds of clients that I think about. The first is a fat client, which is what most of us are accustomed to working on. You have a local disk, you know, a hard drive or a flash card or whatever else, your root file system, and all your applications run locally using your CPU and your RAM, whatever, on the box that you're physically sitting at. All right, standard fat client, that's been around for a long, long time. The second type is a diskless client, which uses may boot from a network device, like a network card or something like that. So it uses a remote disk or a network disk for the root file system, but everything executes locally. Has anyone ever played with the terminal server mode that is on the more recent versions of NOPix? Anyone ever tried that? It's pretty cool. That's what NOPix does, is it sets you up with a diskless environment. It's not a thin client we're going to come to in a minute. So what happens is the disk runs off the NOPix CD on a remote machine, but everything executes locally. It's just NFS mounted. Okay? So you don't see this too often, but they do exist. I think maybe more in the Sun, Solaris world and Spark stuff, you do more diskless stuff. And the third kind is a thin client, which is both a remote or a network disk, and it's also remote execution of the applications that you're running. Typically, it can be running on what we call a terminal server. That's kind of a generic term. A terminal server doesn't necessarily mean it has terminals physically connected to it, just sort of an old-school term that has been perpetuated and persist to this day. So a thin client is what we're going to be looking at, and that's what works with the LTSP project. There are different kinds of thin clients. A fat client, or, you know, fat client hardware, can be a thin client. You just don't run it off of the internal disk or file system, and you don't execute applications with the local CPU and the local RAM. That's actually how the laptops that I've set up here are going to be running. They are going to be a regular fat client machine running in thin client mode. There are also dedicated thin clients, which are usually very small, inexpensive, simple machines that have a minimum of CPU, a minimum of RAM, and are designed to boot and run from the network and access the terminal server. They're available from a lot of different places, Wise, and there's a whole bunch. I don't remember all the different names for them, but they've been around for quite a while, too. Yeah, quick question?
How are you differentiating X-terminal and teletype?
I'm not. The question is, how do I differentiate between an X-terminal and a teletype? I don't even know what a teletype is, so I'm not. It's just the same thing. It's just one is graphical, one is text. I guess that would be my differentiation, but I don't know enough about teletypes to really answer that. Okay. Well, I sort of know what that is. Whenever I have to use PuTTY, sometimes it tells me what VT100 is. Okay. All right. So why would we want to use thin clients? What's so great about them? Well, in my opinion, the question to ask is, well, why wouldn't you use them? I mean, they do so many cool things. What is so great? You know, why would you not be using them? Well, there's a few reasons. One is a thin client is not particularly useful when you're not on the LAN. All right? Thin client technology is generally on a local area network, not a wide area network or, you know, across dial-up or you know, across a net connection or whatever. Typically, and not always, but typically, a thin client is going to run on a LAN. So if you're in an area that has your terminal server and whenever you plug in, hey, you're all good to go. On an airplane at 30,000 feet, a thin client is not particularly useful. All right? So that's one reason. It's also not particularly suited for home use, mainly because there's just not enough of a need. The area where thin clients excel is when you have one terminal server and lots of clients. I'm probably the exception to the rule because I have so many machines at my house, but most of us probably don't have 50 computers at home. We have, you know, like normal people, we have 10, right? So you don't need that many. You know, the benefits are not as great. So you're probably not going to use a thin client environment at home, you know, unless you have lots and lots of people at your house who are trying to do work. I wouldn't know anything about that, but, you know, that's one reason why you're probably not going to use it there. The place where thin clients make the most sense is in a business environment where you have lots of computers in a relatively small area, all basically doing the same thing, where your goal is to have consistency and reliability and simplicity. That's what you're going for. In a business environment, you're a lot of the things that thin clients don't do particularly well, which we're going to talk about in a moment, don't matter that much. So the way, where thin clients are going to be most beneficial is in a corporate setting. So that's actually what we're going to be looking at is more that kind of usage rather than anything else. All right, so what are the good things about a thin client? Well, the first is speed. Because the thin clients are typically going to be connected to a terminal server, which is usually a very high-speed machine with lots of CPU, lots of RAM, fast disks, you know, SCSI arrays and all that kind of stuff, you tend to get very, very good performance, even when you have a lot of users, you know, connected to it. Because, you know, most of the time, your session is sitting idle, waiting for human input, or you're getting a cup of coffee, or doing whatever. So even though you may have 50 machines all connected to a terminal server, most of those machines are in a fairly idle state. All right, so the one or two machines that are doing something basically get full access to all that super speedy hardware. It's much the same way that virtualization makes a lot of sense because most servers are idle a lot of the time. You can have a lot of virtual servers on a physical box and have them all get the benefits of very fast performance, even though they're all sort of competing for resources. It ends up not being a big deal. same situation. The other nice thing about a thin client setup is that everything is managed in one place, on that terminal server. Right? All your user definitions, on that terminal server. All the applications that people run are on that terminal server. Everything that you do, all your network settings, all the security stuff, yada, 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 is all on your terminal server. You don't have to manage 20, 30, 50 individual fat clients. You manage one or two or whatever big fat terminal servers, and that takes care of it. You want to install a new application? You install it once, not 50 times. You know, you need to update some application. You update it once, not 50 times. So that's the real benefit from a system administration point of view, is managing a terminal server is much, much easier than managing however many desktops, you know, you would otherwise have, however many fat clients you would otherwise have. There's reduced hardware costs because, again, you don't have to worry about, you know, upgrading 50 fat clients or however many you have every few years because, you know, they're, oh, gee, well, our machines are 2 or 3 years old. We've got to get brand new ones, right? Just throw some more Reese's on your server, and there you go. Everyone twice as fast as they were before. And because thin clients don't really wear out, it doesn't matter if your thin client isn't fast. It's irrelevant. It's how fast is the server. I don't know about you guys. I would much rather replace one or two servers than 50 desktops. If you've ever been in that boat before, you know what it's like. And there's a whole lot of other factors, too. Less noise, lower power consumption, more portability, easier to back up, easier to upgrade, quicker to replace, and so on and so on and so on. I'm really quite surprised, actually, that thin clients are not more popular than they are. I think it's a testament to the sort of Windows mentality that everyone has a big, fat PC with tons and tons of local resources, and that's just what everyone has grown up with, and that's what they expect. Thin clients have just haven't really caught on. I'm hoping that changes. As a system administrator, I really, really, really hope that changes because it makes my life a lot easier. All right? Yes, Jason, question. Well, a remote X session is essentially a thin client. That is how it works. So there is no difference because it's the same thing. All right. Now, there's a lot of good things about thin clients, but there's some things that they don't necessarily do very well. One of those things is access to local devices, things like USB sticks, local printers, sound, etc. Those kinds of things are a little trickier to get working with a thin client because everything that you do is running on the server. You plug something in locally, your thin client says, hey, look, I got a USB drive. But the server doesn't know about it. All right? This is improving by leaps and bounds all the time. In fact, I just heard from Greg that Red Hat is sending some people up to Ann Arbor, Michigan to work with Jim McQuillan, who's the founder of the LTSP project, on some of these very things. So it's improving. It's getting better all the time. I didn't bother to set up on the demo tonight, but my understanding is that if you're willing to put a little effort into it, you can make those things work. But it's definitely not as slick or as simple as it is with a regular fat machine, with a regular fat client. So that's one limitation. Yes, Dan. So the next Edubuntu will have LTSB very tightly integrated with a lot of the whiz-bang doodads turned on by default. Okay? Good, thanks. Other things like accelerated 3D, for example, probably isn't going to work so well in a thin client environment either. This might be better. I never really have gotten the urge to try it, but maybe it is there. I don't believe, however, that thin clients work with accelerated 3D. So you're not going to have 50 people all playing VZ Flag all on the same actual server. I don't think it's going to work that way. But I could be wrong. All right, don't quote me on that, but I don't believe so. One fairly obvious limitation is that you're really putting all your eggs in one basket when you run thin clients in a terminal server. If that terminal server goes down or is otherwise unavailable, you don't have one person out of work or sitting there twiddling their thumbs. You have 50 people twiddling their thumbs. Yeah, so just like the good old days, Rick says. So that is a limitation. All right. The way around that is, of course, to build your terminal server and your thin client environment on solid software like Linux, and to use solid hardware like good servers. All right. Don't try to cheap yourself out and say, oh, I'm going to set up a little thin client environment here, the terminal server, you know, running on some 4-year-old piece of crap. You're going to regret it. If you're really going to depend on it, you've got to use good quality hardware with redundant parts and, you know, power supplies and ECC RAM and all, you know, your uptime is absolutely critical. So that is a downside. People ask me that whenever I talk about thin clients. Well, what if the server goes down? Well, then you're screwed. You know, it's really the long and the short of it. But, you know, if you do your homework and you do it right, it's not that big a deal. Yes, Dave. The question is, how does LTSP stand up with clustering and other high availability solutions like that? The answer is, I don't know. I don't have much experience in the HA realm. Can anyone else answer that? Okay, that's a bit of an esoteric niche. I see no reason, though, why it wouldn't work. You know, if you were to use a, you know, like a SAN backend and have multiple terminal servers all accessing the same user files, in theory, you should be able to fail over from one and have a pickup on another. That's all theory, though. I haven't actually done that.
Generally, in the past, with other similar solutions, like all their externs and all, with a high availability backend, you can reconnect immediately for the same reason Jason was saying. Your session's gone because it's too much on wire. You're never going to be able to connect to a live.
You have to transfer that entire state to another machine.
There might be something coming with some of those things, like VMware does promotion. We can move a running machine. They can bring up a failed pretty fast, but it's not instantaneous.
Right. I saw a hand in the back, too. Roger. Okay. Jason?
I know that David Ross was telling me about some stuff that read in the magazine about how they're actually looking at a hardware-level redundancy where literally you have a network card between two machines that are syncing up, and that they sync the state of pretty much all their services between each other. And that's the technology that's starting to mature now, so possibly something like that could be used for high availability.
Could be. There's also a project, DRBD or something like that, with like a heartbeat scripting.
Yeah, that's exactly.
So there's something similar in software. So I'm sure there are ways to do that to answer the original question. I'm not going to get into those, but apply those as you see fit. And finally, the last point I'm going to make, is that you do have to take special care to restrict client actions on a terminal server. Bear in mind that you have 50 people running on one piece of hardware, right, on one server. You know, they are essentially all local connections. In fact, to set up the environment that I did tonight, I spent a good bit of time playing around and figuring out how to turn off things like suspended disk and hibernation and stuff like that. Something you might not really think about, you know, on your local machine, but if I have a whole bunch of people on one box and someone decides to be, you know, the jerk, you know, they could shut that box down or make it unavailable. You know, also, you know, things like, fork bombs and other, you know, process limitation things. There's a lot of ways that a user could bring a server down. So, you know, it takes a good amount of due diligence to make sure that, you restrict users as much as possible from doing something malicious. I know that nobody would do anything malicious, like during a presentation or something like that, but the possibility exists. You know, I'm not gonna lie to you. So testing and thorough debugging of a terminal server environment is very important. All right. So with the theory behind this, let me start and talk about actually setting up LTSP. Before I go into all that, let me explain the environment. Everything for the talk tonight is running on a T42 laptop with a bone stock Ubuntu Dapper desktop install. Nothing tricky done to it. That's all. All right. The first thing that I did is install NFS, DHCP daemon, and TFTP daemon. The actual names are, I think, DHCP3-server, TFTPD-HPA, and NFS kernel server, something like that. Anyway, you're going to need these installed because these services all provide the fundamental infrastructure that makes it possible to run a thin client. I will try to spruce up these notes, and I'll put more detailed information at the end before I make it available to everybody. But real quickly, you're going to have NFS, DHCP server, and TFTP daemon. Now, in theory, you don't have to have all those running on the same box. You can, in theory, have NFS running on one machine, DHCP running on a second one, TFTP running somewhere else, and have them all work together. In practice, that's a pain in the neck. You're really probably not going to want to do that, at least not the first time. So if you actually want to try this out, and I encourage you to try it out because it's really freaking cool, make it simple. Just build one box, install all the daemons on it, and boom, away you go. You're also probably going to want to have a minimum of two network interfaces on your terminal server or your LTSP server. The reason is that one of those interfaces is going to be used for the thin clients and nothing but the thin clients. All right, that's how we have things set up here. In my case, on the laptop, I'm using the onboard Ethernet as the thin client interface, and the Wi-Fi is as the WAN interface. All right, so you're going to want to have a dedicated network just for the thin clients. So if you have other machines in the network, other servers, internet access, et cetera, that's going to be, you're really going to want to have that on a separate interface, a separate network. Don't try to skimp and say, oh, I can figure out how to do it all with one NIC. You can't. Or you'll drive yourself nuts trying to figure it out. So make your life easy. Install two NICs. Make one NIC just for the terminal servers, for the thin clients. We'll actually look at this in a little while. And I would suggest configuring one of those interfaces to 192.168.0.1. In theory, you could have it be any IP address that you want. In reality, the LTSP scripts that are part of the stock package are all coded around that IP address. All right? Yeah, you can go through and change them all, but it really doesn't matter because it's a dedicated thin client network. So make your life easy. Make one of your interfaces 192.168.0.1. You'll be doing yourself a favor. All right? Note that none of this so far has anything to do with LTSP packages. All right, this is just the preliminary stuff to get the basics set up on your LTSP or your terminal server so that we can start using the LTSP project. All right, so how to actually install the LTSP stuff? Well, the first thing you're going to do is go to ltsp.org and grab either a RPM, a Debian file, or a tarball of the latest version, which I think is 4.2 release 3 or something like that. It's an incredibly small package. I think the Debian file is like 32K. It's tiny. It's almost nothing. It's really just a collection of scripts that run and generate the rest of the environment. All right, we will be looking at that in just a bit. By the way, you will find that there may exist LTSP packages, either RPMs or DEBs, from other sources. Like Debian or Ubuntu have LTSP packages in their repositories. My suggestion is not to use them. I have found that there's some things about them that don't quite, they work a little differently than the documentation for LTSP suggests. And I tried for a while to get them to work, and I wasn't being successful. I had much better luck just running the stock Debian packages available from the LTSP folks directly. Again, that as Dan indicated, that may be changing in the near future, but for now I would suggest not using the LTSP packages provided by your distro. Instead, grab the ones directly from the LTSP.org folks. Oops, well, I went too far, whatever. All right, once you have your package installed, you're going to run the LTSP admin script. We're going to run through this, even though I already have it installed, I'll run through and show you what it does. It's very straightforward. All this script does is go through and download a bunch of tarballs from the LTSP.org site, from their repository, and extract them to a directory by default in /opt. All right? This is the directory that is used to boot the thin clients themselves. We'll look at this in more detail in a little while. But that's basically what the LTSP admin package does, is it builds your thin client environment. All right, and we're going to look at that. Or, if you want to make your life easier, and this is what I did, you can also grab an ISO image from LTSP.org, which contains the Debian packages, or the RPMs and the tarballs, along with all of the tarballs that are needed to create the thin client environment. It's much easier to download the ISO, get it done all at once. That way, if you ever decide, oh, geez, I screwed up, I got to redo it, I don't have to go download 50 megs of stuff again. You've already got them. So I think it's about a 90-something megabyte ISO, quite small, so you shouldn't have any problem downloading it and use that.
So LTSP admin is like a package manager for LTSP, is that right?
The question is that LTSP admin, is it like a package manager? The answer is, I guess you could think of it that way. Really, all it does is grab a bunch of tarballs and tar.xvf them to opt.
But the client stuff, I guess, is packaged using that rather than DEBs or RPMs or...
That's correct.
Whatever.
That's correct. There's no DEBs or RPMs in the thin client environment. The thin client environment, we're going to look at in a little while, is really just a very, very minimal environment that exists just enough code to run X and a couple other things. That's it. It's a very minimal set of binaries. We will look at exactly what that is in just a little while here. All right? So the installation itself is really very straightforward. All right? Once everything is installed, you run another utility, another script called LTSPconfig, LTSPCFG. What this will do is show you the status of your LTSP server, and give you the option of assisting you with configuration. All right, we're going to step through this in a little while, but basically you're going to use it to help you configure DHCP and NFS, your host file, the master lts.conf, and a few other things. It is there to make your life easier. It doesn't do anything that you can't do by hand. It just makes your life a little bit easier. In particular, getting the DHCP server file is critical because everything stems off of that. We will look at that just a bit. Okay? Although it gives the option of helping you set up TFTP and XDMCP, I would suggest you do this manually. Who is familiar? Does anyone not know what TFTP is? Really? Everyone in this room knows what TFTP is. Now all the hands come up. Okay. TFTP stands for Trivial File Transfer Protocol. It's akin to regular FTP, but it's much less important. That's why it's so trivial. It's a very simplistic way of transferring files across the network. Anyone who's ever configured a Cisco router has probably used TFTP, all right, with Hyperterminal or Minicom or whatever, to move a config file or a ROM or whatever, or an image across a serial line. That's one way it gets used. It's a very simple way of moving files from one location to another.
Commonly used for embedded systems.
Who does not know what XDMCP? All right, a few more hands on that. All right, it stands for the X Display Manager Control Protocol. I think I got that right. Basically, it is a protocol that allows you to have an X session running from something other than the host that you're sitting at, other than the X server, the X client. Server. I always get them confused. X always has everything backwards and forwards. The thin client runs the X server. I love X. It's brilliant. XDMCP, in most cases, anybody who runs a Linux box or you're running X, the odds are incredibly good that XDMCP is turned off because you're usually not allowing, logins, graphical logins from a remote host. You can allow, SSH and whatever, but that's got nothing to do with XDMCP. It's just for X. It's just a log-on protocol for X, all right? Because we're using thin clients, we have to allow that, all right? I'll show you exactly how this is edited. It's actually very, very simple. It's a single line in GDM or KDM, depending on which display manager you're using, or XDM if you're old school. And finally, you're going to need to make a few minor edits to the DHCP config file. This is because by default, the LTSP config utility doesn't configure certain file names properly. So we'll look at that too. All right. So the whole setting up of the server, after you've gone, the first time is probably going to take you a while, but once you've done it, you can actually knock through it in about 10 minutes. I did it so many times setting this up, I could probably do it in about three. It's really quite straightforward. It's editing a handful of config files. Setting up the thin client is even easier. The easiest way, if you have your server set up properly, is to just use Pixie booting. All right, does everyone know what I mean when I say Pixie boot?
No.
All right. PXE, Pixie, stands for pre-boot execution environment. Pre-boot execution environment, right. It's a protocol that was developed by, I'm pretty sure it was developed by Intel, although they may have some help with some other networking folks. And it's a way of allowing a system to net boot, essentially. It's kind of like TFTP. It's a very, very simple protocol with very minimal overhead, and it works by querying a DHCP server and sending in a special code that says, I'm Pixie booting. I'm not regular booting. I'm Pixie booting. If your DHCP server is listening for that code, and you tell it to pass it a special option, it'll hand off a bootstrap file, and then it'll allow it to load additionally. There's a bunch of steps involved, and I'm not going to get into all of them because I don't really understand them very well myself. But long story short, is Pixie booting is basically a way to boot a machine directly from a network. No local drive is ever involved whatsoever. Strictly 100% network booting. It may be, yes. If you have an onboard NIC, it will probably be set up in the BIOS. If you're using a regular PCI NIC, like Intel's, for example, because Intel developed it, they really have the best Pixie support. When the card comes up during the post, you'll have like the option to hit Control S. So I got an Intel NIC. Freecom's probably have their own one. I'm sure Netgear's have one and whatever else. And that gives you a few options to configure. Most of the time, it just works right out of the box. There's really very little to do with it. The question is, what's the difference between Pixie booting and boot P?
Perhaps the relationship.
Yeah, it's sort of like the next generation.
Functionality, the same, and boot P was typically done not from the BIOS on the NIC, but older machines with smart consoles would have that built in them, and they had the boot P packet built in, whereas Pixie is more focused on the network adapter.
I think the main difference is that Pixie is just more flexible. It has more options. It can do more things than BootP is. I mean, DHCP is really a successor to BootP. Pixie is not a successor to DHCP, but it works hand in hand with DHCP. We'll actually see this in action as soon as I'm done blabbing about all this stuff. All right. If your thin client is not capable of booting using Pixie or PXE booting, you can use something called Etherboot. There's two versions of it. One is you can buy a NIC which has an Etherboot ROM already installed. I've seen it for sale for about $35 or $40, although I wonder why, because you can buy a Pixie NIC even cheaper, so I don't really see the point to that. Where it does come in handy, though, is if you have a bunch of old machines, old Pentium 75s or whatever, those make very nice thin clients if you choose to set them up that way. But if they can't Pixie boot, then the workaround is to make an Etherboot floppy. And it'll boot up the floppy, and it's a very, very tiny amount of code, which basically makes the NIC able to get the kernel and everything else it needs from the DHCP server, and things go on from there. It's a bunch of magic. I don't know how it works, but it does work. To do Etherboot, what you do is you go to the ROM-O-Matic website, romomatic.net. It's real. I'm not making that up. And there's a list of thousands of network cards and all these different models, and you're going to spend like 5 hours figuring out which one you need. But once you get it, it's all well and good. You get a little teeny tiny file that you DD to a floppy, pop the floppy in your thin client, it'll boot, it'll find the NIC, and it'll start getting the kernel it needs, and you go on from there. It is a very good way of using thin clients on older hardware that is not capable of Pixie booting. These days, you can get Pixie, you know, Pixie NICs are so cheap, there's really no reason not to use them. But you have options. All right? So, you got your server set up, you got your client set up. Let's walk through the process real quick. The first thing that happens is your thin client should pull an IP address from the DHCP server. Usually you'll see that. You know, it'll say in the very beginning, you know, getting IP address 192.168.0.50 or whatever it may be. All right. If you don't get that, if you never get an IP address, then your DHCP server is probably either misconfigured or not running. All right. It's a very common problem when you're first setting up a terminal server is, you know, if it doesn't work at all, it's probably because DHCP isn't configured right. All right. So once you figure that out by reading lots of log files and doing lots of Googling, and you get your DHCP server working, your thin client is going to pull an address. The next thing it does is part of the DHCP handout is a path to a file. All right, that file is obtained using TFTP. So your thin client is actually a TFTP client, and it gets a file from the TFTP server, which is your terminal server. All right, if that doesn't work, you get an IP address, but you don't get your file, which is actually a kernel, the Linux kernel, then it's probably because TFTP isn't configured. So, again, more Googling, more reading logs, more hand-wringing, lots of drinking. So now your thin client gets an IP address, it gets a kernel, and then it says, it gives you a kernel panic. So it can't find root or some error like that. That usually means you have an NFS error. Because after it gets a kernel, an IP address, and then a kernel, it attempts to mount a root file system via NFS from your server. If it can't do that, you're going to get a kernel panic. All right. So if you get to stage 3 and it craps that on you, well, now you know where to look. Jason?
Maybe I'm thinking of a little bit too neat, but does TFTP just grab a kernel or does it grab a whole environment or what? I mean, what's the bridge between just having a kernel and getting an IP and an NFS client? So,
TFTP just grabs the kernel. That is all. We'll look at the config for that in a moment. TFTP just grabs the kernel. The kernel boots, and then one of the options that's passed to the kernel tells it to NFS mount the root file system. It's called a pivot root. That's all I know about. It's called pivot root. That's how it hands off from the Pixie environment or whatever to the kernel that is now executing in RAM. Alan.
Right.
You actually run. That's correct. Well, you actually have to get an IP address twice.
Yep.
First with Pixie, and then after the kernel boots and amounts of your NFS file system, then it gets then it requests an IP address again. It should be the same IP address because it's the same MAC address. But you actually go through. If you actually watch your DHCP server logs, you'll get a request twice. Once for the Pixie environment, assuming you're using Pixie, and once for the for your real Linux file system. Question in the back. I haven't. You'll see why two NICs are useful once we actually get the environment up. Trust me. Trust me on that. Yeah, only on the server. The clients only have one NIC. Okay? So now you've got your IP address, you've got your kernel, you've mounted your NFS file system, and now you have now X starts, and you have a big gray screen with an X, with the old style X cursor sitting in the middle, and that's all you have. All right? That means you don't have XDMCP configured correctly. All right? Because the server is not allowing a log on session from the remote machine. All right. So if you get that far, and there's a whole big section on troubleshooting that in the LTSP documentation. But bottom line is, it simply means you don't have XDMCP configured properly. And it's usually just one line in your display manager config. That's all it is. but it's easy to overlook, and sometimes it gets overwritten or whatever, and you freak out because, oh, my God, I got this black thing in the site, and I don't have my terminal. Simple XDMCP error. I hate XDMCP because it's such a pain in the neck to say. Okay? So you go through the whole process, and now you've got your thin client up and running. All right? There's a few things that you can do to tweak that process in opt LTSP, blah, 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 LTS.conf. That is where you can set options for specific workstations. What kind of options would I want to set? Well, you might want to set a default display resolution on client machine 47 or whatever. Maybe you know the person using that has bad eyes and they want to have a real low resolution. You can force the resolution in this file. You can change the different the screen behaviors, Control F1, Control F2, Control F3. Those can all have different things running on them. And you can configure those on a client-by-client basis if you so desire. If you want to configure things like different local device options, they would go in this file. So the LTS.conf is sort of the master for configuring the various workstations. Typically, though, you're just going to use the defaults, though. And that's all I've done here. I haven't set any client-specific settings for any of the stuff that I've set up here. So it's all just running from the defaults. And the defaults work pretty darn well. I mean, it'll automatically detect your screen resolution, your mouse type, and all that, and it usually gets it right. It didn't used to. In earlier versions of LTSP, it sometimes would choke on things, but it's pretty good. It's pretty good with it now. All right. So, okay. Well, all right. I'll go through. All right. So, that's all stuff. Well, that's all well and good. So, I'm not going to bore you guys with any more PowerPoint crap. Let's actually sit down and look at an honest to God working LTSP server. Is this text large enough for people to read? I'll take that as a no. The problem is that I can bump it up, but I don't think this thing... Oops. It kind of cuts it off a little bit. All right, that'll have to do. How's that? Usable? Yay? Okay, good enough. Okay, I'm going to go back, and I actually have to refresh my memory here, so I'm going to go back. Blah, 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 blah. One of the first things we're going to do, all right, let's real quick look at the preliminary tasks on here. Dpackage dash. This way, because this is Ubuntu or Debian, so I'll be using a lot of dpackage stuff. You. All right, so the NFS kernel server is one of the things you're going to have to install that is not typically installed by default. Ditto for TFTP. You need to make sure you have this installed. And what was the last one I said? DHCP. All right, so this is the magic one here. DHCP client and common are typically installed since a lot of machines are DHCP clients, but DHCP server is not. So you'll have to install this. How you install it depends on which distribution you're using. All right, so those are installed. And then what do we do next? All right, let's look at our network interfaces. All right, it doesn't read very well with this big text, but... all right, you can see it. All right, so ETH0 is my onboard Ethernet port, wired Ethernet port, which you'll notice I've set to 192.168.0.1, just like I said I would. ETH1 is my wireless, and thank goodness it's on a different subnet. If it wasn't, I'd probably have a problem, but this pulling it from the Trilog router. All right, so that's where our Internet connection is coming from. All right, so our interfaces are configured. That's all very nice. All right. Yes? Yeah, you could do that. The question is, could you have, like, a virtual interface on one NIC? Yeah, you could. that you're still going to have the issue of you're going to have two DHCP servers on that subnet. You know, maybe having VLANs separating them, then maybe it's a different story, but...
The servers have to be a lot of network traffic.
Yeah. Just,
so you might run into traffic.
Just trust me. Come on, a NIC is like $5. I mean, I'll give everyone in this room a NIC if they don't ask me why they have to have two of them. Just trust me. You got to have two NICs, all right? Just take my word for it. Okay. You can see here, through the beauty of wrapping, this is the ISO file that I have gotten from the LTSP project. Let's do a real quick mounting of that. LTSP and mount. All right. What you see in here is a whole bunch of LTSP tarballs, gzip tarballs, all with various stuff. All right. This is the question that kind of Rick was alluding to. These are the various packages that are installed to the thin client environment. All right. We're going to look at that in just a second here. But what we want to go to first is this directory right here called LTSP utils. All right. And in there are the three files that are available for different distributions. There's an RPM, a DEB, and a tarball for those of you who run, you know, Slackware. All one of you. Yeah, our resident Slackware expert is no longer here, so we don't have to listen to anybody talk about it. And you see how small they are. The RPM is 39K. The DEB is 34K. Very, 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 very small. And since this is already installed, LTSP-utils, that's it. Three files. That's what this package consists of. It's almost a shame you have to use a package manager for that. But that's all it is. That's all the LTSP stuff is as far as the Debian package or the RPM package that you're installing. Three lousy files. All right. The bulk of the work is done when you run LTSP admin. Now, bear in mind, I've already done this, so I'm not going to redo it for fear of breaking my current installation. And it looks like NCurses is a little bit unhappy with this very large font. But what you're going to do is you're going to install the LTSP packages, all right? And there's a whole bunch of them here. Typically, you're going to hit A to select all of them. Now, if you really want to, you can go through and figure out which ones you want, which ones you don't. Don't even bother. Just take them all, all right, at least for the first time. All right, work with me on this. All right, so now are you ready to install them? All right, I've already run it, so it's already. I've already gone through the configuration of where do you get them from. You can either get them from a network mirror, typically from LTSP.org, or you can get them from a local source. When I go to configure, this is actually the source that has to be defined first. You'll notice that my source for this file is /mnt, which is where I just loop back map that ISO file from. All right, so it just gets them lickety-split, does them in no time. It takes 10 seconds. All right, and then when you tell it where to get the files from, and you tell it to take all of them and install them, it runs through and does this little dance, and what it does is it installs the LTSP directory in /opt is the default location. Of course, you can change that, but by default, it will install it to /opt. Now, I have two directories in here because I've been kind of goofing around with this a little bit. I think you only end up with one, just the LTSP directory. All right? So in opt LTSP, the main directory that we care about is this I386. And inside opt LTSP I386, that looks kind of like a regular root file system on a typical Linux box. You have bin and etsy and home and proc and root and, you know, user and var and all that good stuff. All right, this is the thin client environment. All right, all of these files are NFS mounted by each thin client to the terminal server, and that's where it gets its local code from. There's just enough code in this directory to probe the hardware, run X, and do an XDMCP log on back to the terminal server. That's it. Not very much. Yes. We're going to get to that. The answer is yes, but they're not in this side this. They're in your normal environment. All right, this is just the thin client environment. All right, you'll notice it's 253 megabytes. It's relatively trim. You know, it probably could be pared down a lot there, so I'm sure there's some stuff in here like Perl and whatnot that we probably don't need, or maybe it's needed for scripting, I don't know. I'm sure this could be stripped down, but who really cares? I mean, when a 300 gig hard drive is $80, who really gives a crap about 253 megs? So, this is the thin client root file system, all right? Opt LTSP I386. So this is what happens when you run LTSP admin and you tell it to get the files. This is the end result. All right, so we've gone through this steps, the installation. Next, let's look at the configuration. LTSP config. It goes through and checks all the services that are necessary for running a thin client. And now you can do two things. You can show the status, and you can go through a manual configuration. The first time you run this, you're going to hit C and go through the configuration. I've already done that, so I'm going to show the status real quickly. And unfortunately, it's a nice little kind of a curses-based thing, but it scrolls off the edge because our font is so large. But what it gives you is it shows your whatever interfaces are installed. And this little arrow here says which one is active, the various services that you need to boot a thin client, DHCP and TFTP and PortMapper and NFS go together, and XDM and yada, 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 and a few auxiliary files, your default run level. You can have a thin client boot into text mode if you want. Most people boot into graphical mode. If you're on a Red Hat type system, your run level would probably be 5. In text mode, it would be 3. Debian is run level 2 for everything, so it doesn't quite work that way. So this is the LTSP config status page. Again, it will look better on a normal size font than it does here. But you can also go through and configure. And it gives you this little menu and lets you go through your various things that need to be configured. A lot of these things you don't actually have to touch. Generally, you don't have to change the run level. It will already be correct. The interface selection is very straightforward. Just go through and tell it, well, is it ETH0 or is it ETH1? Which is the one for your thin clients? So you're going to tell it ETH0. All right. It'll help you with your DHCP daemon. Do you want to build a dhcpd.conf file? Yes, you're going to want to do that. I've already done so I'm not going to overwrite it. So it's pretty simple. I mean, you got to walk through these. The ones that you definitely have to do are interface selection, DHCP config, NFS config, host entries, exports, and the LTS.conf. So some of them you don't necessarily have to do, because we're going to go through and do them a couple of them manually, because the LTSP stuff doesn't quite get them right, particularly TFTP. It gets a little confused because of how it's set up. All right, so you're going to run through and go through those various things, and it gives you some little messages along the way. It's fairly verbose and pretty informative. All right, so going through the presentation, we've run LTSP config. We've set up these various services. And now we're going to go through and manually set up XDMCP and TFTPD. The reason I've broken this out and said to do them manually is for two reasons. One is because the LTSP stuff frequently gets them wrong. It tries to guess where they are, how they're supposed to be done. It doesn't always get it right. So I find it's actually smarter to do it manually and you know that it's done right. The second reason is you're frequently going to be needing to know where this stuff is done, so it's better off just to understand it the first time and then you're good to go. All right. The first one is TFTP. Now, I don't know how Red Hat does it, but the TFTP daemon on a Debian system is chrooted to var lib TFTP boot. Var lib TFTP boot. And you'll see there's nothing in there. The configuration for the daemon is an etc default And you'll notice that I've commented the original options out and replaced them. It has this goofy thing where I say run daemon yes or no. It's disconfusing for like 2 hours. I couldn't figure out why the hell TFTP wouldn't start, even though I had run rcconf and turned it on. It just wouldn't start. You have to turn it on in two places. I don't understand. So make sure you turn run daemon on to yes. And then the options, you'll notice that by default, the TFTP daemon is chrooted to var lib TFTP boot. Well, that would be all well and good, except that the LTSP config drops the files you really want in slash TFTP boot. So you can either copy them over to the new location or symlink them or do whatever, or just change where the TFTP daemon looks for the files. So I've chosen the latter option. So again, this is one of the things you go through when you're troubleshooting and you're going, well, why the hell is my thin client not getting a kernel? Why is it saying file not found? I put it in the right place. It's in TFTP boot. Well, there's two different locations for it. Again, on a Red Hat system or a SUSE box or a Slackware box or whatever else, this may be different. This is just how Debian does and Ubuntu does TFTP. Right. I'm just sharing with you, so hopefully you won't spend the time that I wasted trying to figure out why the heck it didn't work. So, configure TFTP. Make sure it's pointed to the right location. That right location is TFTP boot. And if we look in here, there's an LTS directory, Linux Terminal Server. And in there, boom, this is the kernel that is actually transferred via TFTP to the thin client so that it can boot. If you run uname-a or whatever on the thin client itself, this is what you would get. Linux 2.6.17-3. All right? So getting TFTP working is sometimes a little fun. The other thing that you're going to need to manually configure is XDMCP. Because I'm running GNOME on this machine, my display manager is GDM. The config is in etc GDM. If you're running KDE, you're probably using KDM. And it's probably in etc KDM, or whatever the case may be. If you're running XDM, I don't have a clue where it is. So wherever your display manager is, it's going to have a config file. GDM.conf. GDM.conf is a big file. All right, I don't remember how many lines it is, but it's a lot. Oh, crap. Did I miss it? Maybe it's capitalized. Oh. Yeah. Back to the top. Yeah, I'll find it here somewhere. Here we go. Okay. This one right in the middle, enable equals true. You'll see how nicely they bury this in here, so you gotta grep around a little bit. So, by default, XDMCP is turned off in GDM. I'm willing to bet that every single person in this room on their Linux machine has XDMCP turned off. Almost every person in this room has XDMCP turned off. Odds are you do, so you will have to go through and edit this. If you do not edit this, and if you get everything else right, your thin client's going to boot up, you're going to get action, you get this big gray screen with the cursor in the middle, and it doesn't do anything else. All right. That's your sign that XDMCP is off. Yeah, you can move the cursor around. You have a running X server, it just can't connect to the terminal server to get a log on. All right? So you do that, you restart your display manager, and the last thing we got to do is configure our DHCP server. The DHCP server is where most of the configuration problems lie because there's several things that go in it that have to be just right. DHCPD.conf. All right. This is basically the file that the LTSP config program generates for you. And you'll note that it uses the 192.168.0.1 for all this stuff. Another reason why you're doing yourself a big favor by setting your interface to that IP address. Otherwise, you got to go through and change all this stuff, which I would really rather not do. All right? The key lines are right here. The option root path, this is passed on to the kernel, and it says, use NFS is implied by the syntax from 192.168.0.1/opt-ltsp-i386. Remember I said that's the thin client environment? That's what gets NFS mounted as the root file system. All right, and that has to be specified here. You also have this section in the middle where it's if substring option vendor class blah, blah, blah equals PXE client, then it passes on a file name option. So when your thin client boots up with Pixie, it sends a message to the DHCP server and says, hi, I'm a Pixie guy. DHCP server recognizes that, and it says, all right, Pixie guy, I want you to get /LTS26...blah-blah-blah-blah-blah, PixieLinux.0. That's the first stage of the Pixie boot process. And I'm not going to get into the gory details of it, but it happens in several stages. Else, if it's not a Pixie boot, then it just says, simply get LTS, VMware, blah, blah, blah. Note that even though this file is in /TFTP boot, you don't see that because TFTP is chrooted. So the path is not /TFTP boot/LTS, blah, blah, blah. That's another mistake that a lot of people make when they don't realize that TFTP is chrooted. You exclude that, wherever the end of that chroot is, and you put what looks like the wrong absolute path, but it's actually right as far as the TFTP daemon is concerned. That's a very common problem. All right? What you will also notice when you install this the first time is that this file name is not going to match the actual file that's in /TFTP boot/LTS. It's probably like 2.6.16-1 or something is what it'll say. That's because the LTSP project updates the kernels every now and again, but for some reason they haven't gotten around to updating the config utility. So you go through all this stuff and the damn thing still won't work. And it's because it's the wrong file name. Don't ask me why that makes me mad. I'm not going to tell you how long I spent figuring that one out.
I'm actually beginning to think that the real thing to avoid, other than saying, you know, keep it on one network or what, is avoid that damn program and build the config files yourself. And then you can really do what you want to do.
If you really understand the syntax for a DHCP server, go ahead and configure it yourself. It actually gives you a good starting point. There's just a couple of things that you do have to fix. It'd be nice if it was smart enough to read the correct location and give you the right config from the get-go, but hey, it's open source. Write it yourself. Good little project for you, you know, for someone to work on. Okay? So, you fix your DHCP config file, you restart the daemon, and now you're ready to boot a thin client. All right? Because everyone loves live demonstrations because they always work, right? So this is one of my 300 laptops that are floating around my house. Ethernet plugged into a little switch up here, plugged into the T42 on the 192.168.0 subnet. Should be set to Pixie boot. If this song doesn't work. All right, so DHCP is looking for an address. It got one. This goes by a little too quickly, but what actually happened in that brief period of time is it got an IP, and then immediately used TFTP to pull the kernel, boots the kernel, does a pivot root, NFS mounts the root file system in Opt LTS I386, starts up X, connects to the display manager via XDMCP, and we have a thin client. Right, still got to log in. Right. Everybody thinks it's going to be Bob, right? But it's not. Nice try. I'm sorry? This one? It's like a P400 or something like that. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter what it is. This could be a... This is a Pentium M 1.7. I mean, it's relatively fast. It's a fairly... It's a year-old laptop. So it's pretty quick. Yes, it was. All right. So here's your user. And if you were to look at the display on my local laptop, it's exactly the same. Everything that's running on this little laptop is really running over here. Now, I defy anyone to sit down at this machine and start using it and tell me it's running across the network. That's not local. If anything, it's actually quicker. All right. Now, this is the part where I need everyone else's help. I got two more laptops, three laptops up here, I got a couple over there. I want to see how many machines we can get running off of my LTSP server before the night is done. All right, what time is it? Yeah, I've got some fairly long cables. I don't know if they're going to make it that long, but come on up here and let's see how many we can get. So I've got... No, I do not. If you can pixie boot a Wi-Fi, Nick, I'll be damn impressed.
Is there a switch here?
Yes.
That's like beyond impressive.
Really? Okay, so that's probably not pixie. That's Etherboot, not quite the same. Yeah, it's Etherboot, but wow, that'd be cool. Although considering how much Wi-Fi drops packets, I think it's not going to be a real good choice.
I want to see you pixie boot over a VPN.
In theory, that could work. All right, so what I'm going to do is over here. I'm going to go out and run top, and let's just see what kind of load this thing gets. It's obviously something. It must be incompatible with your laptop. It's probably it then. The list of logins everyone can use. These are all the users. The username and password is the same. So the EDED, Fenster.
So this one is just getting the X from your server, not getting the display manager. We have more cable
checks. It went to the wrong screen. Just because I've been using this one before. I do not have any. If anyone has any network cables, I've... No. The network traffic that you see with this seems to average about a megabit per connection, megabit per thin client. So you can imagine if you have 50 thin clients all being heavily used on a 100 megabit network, you're going to start to approach really what you can practically do. Yeah.
I'm working in the JW world.
Hold that question. All right. So we got machines up. We've got internet connection. This machine has a gig, so I don't know. It depends on how many applications people run, but it's pretty efficient. Oh, on the client? Yeah, 16 megs is plenty.
All you got to do is put
the
memory.
It's just enough to run an X server. That's all. That's all. I think 16 is probably, even 32. I've done it with 8 a long time ago, but not lately.
Who's the HTTP client for your server support? Who's getting
HTTP server? He had the same problem. It's probably because the kernel that we're using isn't happy with your hardware, so it's probably, that's just not going to make a good thin client, is the bottom line. You should best be able to run W. Or who? W or who? All right. So you have a bunch of people. Hey, I got something else cool to show you guys. You're gonna want to see this. All right. So you guys can continue. Go ahead and booting. And how many we got up? We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So we got at least 7 thin clients running off of this machine. Well, who doesn't always show them? I've learned that. It's strange, but for some reason it doesn't always show them. Well, you have to do a PF and grep for the first and run unique or something. All right? Now, I'm doing this on the server, so you can't see it. All right. So I've switched over to the server now. All right. On the terminal server, all right, pay attention. On the terminal server, I'm going to now kick off VMware with a Windows 2000 server instance.
Oh, no.
And we're going to let that run in the background. It's going to take a little while to boot because we got all this other activity. All right. Let's just give that a minute or two. And then like a couple, well, you know what? Now that I've kicked that off, let me demonstrate on this one. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and log this user off. I'm on the thin client now. So we log off. All right, and it goes back to GDM. Now, because I've defined an additional program in screen number 3, Control-Alt-F3. I said Control-Alt-F3. I'll screw it. I'm just going to print it off. It's a thin client. You can just pull the plug. Who cares? Okay? So, for all the people up here who are actually, you know, playing with it and using it, what does it feel like? Can you tell it's networked? Can you tell it's on a terminal server? Can you tell it's not local? Load average is probably getting a little high. Well, bear in mind, you have 8 machines running off of a laptop hard drive. So it's probably getting stuck on disk I.O. more than anything else. Plus, I'm running VMware. It's a good laptop, but it's, you know. All right. So, my demo laptop up here is booting, and let's just see what happens in a moment or two. Screen number three. All right. Control Alt F3.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. All right. This doesn't seem to like this very much. All right. I'm not sure why it's not. It might not like my laptop chipset.
Resolution?
Yeah, it probably doesn't like it. Yeah, that's right, Chris is.
I'm a sucky laptop, just like
you. Watch your cables. Your cables get
fine.
All right, so we're actually running on screen number three, we're running our desktop connecting to a Windows server running in VMware on the terminal server. So I have one terminal server, both for Linux and Windows, on one box, and you can use both sessions simultaneously. All right, that's pretty effing cool. I don't care who you are. I don't know why this laptop is unhappy with.
Did the cable just pull out of that? Because it just went away for a minute. It won't come back.
No signal.
Yeah, that's kind of neat.
I imagine you could run.
So anyway.
Yeah.
Inside of a VM.
That's what we're doing. We're running a terminal services inside a VM.
I mean on a VM, a ESS server.
Sure.
One of it, the whole thing in ESS.
Sure. All right, so you can do some pretty cool stuff with all this. It looks like the crowd's broken up. Does anyone have any questions before we, yeah?
Having proved that you can run Windows on this laptop server, what is the status of a program like Word or Access or whatnot? Do you have to have multiple licenses?
Yep. Don't ask me about Windows licenses. I have no clue.
Yes.
I'm not going to comment on that. Yeah.
Basically, if you have to make a choice between giving Microsoft more money or less money, the legal choice will always be to give Microsoft more money.
Oh, The license is written.
All right. Well, I'm going to leave this up here running. If anyone wants to come up here and play with them for a little while, or if they have any questions. Otherwise, we're going to call it night, and thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks to our sponsor. Give this a shot. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Try chugging Sammy's afterwards for those who